You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
I'm now joined by Melissa Lang, who is the main author, is that correct, of this new report?
Correct,
about,
yeah.
That's correct?
Yes.
Awesome. Yeah, Melissa Lang is the author of this new report, all looking into, I guess, art ownership of the buildings that they inhabit and more, and we'll get into that very shortly. But first, morena, Melissa, how you doing?
I'm good, morena. It's awesome to be speaking to Dunedin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where are you coming to us from?
Yeah, I'm coming from Tamaki Makaurau, so this is actually my first time on Dunedin Student Radio. I've done BFM, I've done Radioactive, whatever Radio Massey is now called, revealing my age. But one day I get a knockoff every single student radio, it'll be amazing.
Mm-hmm. I think now you've just got to do RDU, yeah, Christchurch. I think Radio Massey, is that now Radio Control? It's one in Palmerston North.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, crack up! I think you just get Christchurch, and then you've got the whole set.
Yeah, I can die happy.
Nice, I'm very glad to hear. Let's get into talking about the meat and potatoes of this new report. It's focused on building ownership in the cultural sectors, and looks at how good custodianship and ownership practices lead to a thriving arts sector. In Aotearoa, it's quite challenging to find artist spaces at affordable rates at the moment. Where did you find were the strongest rates of building ownership in Aotearoa?
Oh, you're going to actually make me consult my document. So I think a lot of that was actually influenced by, obviously, Tamaki Makaurau being also the biggest centre.
Mm.
But in terms of, I didn't actually break it down in terms of where the strongest ownership was, but what was really quite interesting was that how many small centres did actually have some kind of building ownership. So, mm-hmm. for example, Nelson, there's like a Potter's Collective down in Nelson who own their own building because it was gifted to them by a person who adored pottery and left them their estate. There's sort of like this. What I found really interesting when I kind of went looking for building ownership was both. We don't know who owns their building and who's leasing it or who's got a council kind of arrangement. So there was this kind of absolute absence of knowledge. But also the ways in which, you know, surprising sort of small towns had amazing arts infrastructure, like in their own ownership, because of something like a community in the 1950s had raised the money and built the hall, or somebody had gifted a workshop building to a pottery society, or a really liberal council had purchased a building on behalf of a future arts organisation and effectively allowed a new arts organisation to emerge for the building, which is the case of something like McCann House. And so there's these kind of all these amazing sort of histories, but you also then see that something like 65% of the arts sector is leasing, and a lot of them, like a really high number of them, are leasing on month by month or year by year leases. So that lease might roll forever because they've got a really nice landlord, but the largest reason that arts organisations had relocated was because the building was sold or redeveloped. So you've got this kind of inherent underlying precarity in your building, and I'm sure, like in Dunedin and should have practiced. You particularly things like music venues, they get redeveloped, they get resold, and then suddenly you don't have the pub that provided that infrastructure anymore.
Yeah, I mean there's a pretty active kind of Save Dunedin live music campaign happening right now, because there's like real estate and kind of offices that are going up in certain parts of the city which are right next to really historic venue sites, and so that's been a really active effort to try and prevent that, so that our culture is still going on and that our live music scene is still strong. So yeah, it's the whole thing of gentrification, right? That's the problem. Yeah. I think the arts is coming up against.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's really so absolutely gentrification. And there was an article I think only yesterday in the spin-off about up here in Auckland, about one of the youth music venues having to close because it was basically happening in a suburban area, and the youth, of course, were drinking outside, but
as they are to do,
you can kind of see there's this absolute tension with like zoning and noise and, as you know, general use change. Mm. And so I don't think even in that particular case, like, you know, owning the building wouldn't save you, because that's actually kind of a zoning issue and a use change issue. But there is this kind of relationship then, like, the arts has with the development cycle, the economic cycle of buildings, because when the economy is like in the dumps and people aren't using the houses, and Nicola Willis is saying, go back to work, all the offices are empty and you can actually rent cheap spaces. And when, like, the inner city, you know, economy is thriving, you're pushed out because you don't have that kind of stability of tenure, you don't have that ownership that actually allows you to hold on. So places like in London, they realised that this was a major issue, that while the arts economy drives so much of London's desirability, the studio and workspace and presentation space affordability was so low that the very thing that made, you know, Britain great was being pushed out of London. And so they've actually set up what they call a Creative Land Trust, where they receive and hold on behalf of the arts buildings, which they then write up contracts for leasing, which is affordable leasing. So you kind of like, well, all these quite amazing strategies that we could be taking to lock in permanent infrastructure for the arts at affordable rates if we are willing to commit and invest in them.
I think I might have a sneeze coming on, but it's kind of just dissipating into the back of my nose now. Oh, I hate when that happens. I'm so sorry.
You gotta look at the lights.
Oh, look at the lights, yeah. You mentioned before about stability, and a key finding with this report was that the arts are fundamentally, well, at the moment, sorry, space-stressed and unstable. According to your report, only 13% of your survey respondents and art organisations actually owned their premises, with half of the survey respondents moving once or more in the last 5 years, and one-third of respondents spending over 30% of their income on accommodation. By accommodation, do you mean paying for art spaces or rent for, like, an actual living for your actual house?
So we specifically, because what was really interesting was a couple of years before I did this report, the Point Chevalier Trust Social Enterprise did a national survey on housing, like domestic housing, and they found again like that artist housing was, like, artists had a lower ownership rate of domestic housing than their comparative age groups, and that. So artists were incredibly housing in a domestic sense stressed. This study and this, like, so the survey and the report and the case studies really focused on professional housing. Now, what was really interesting was, like, we got probably 70% of the responses were from organisations and 30% of the responses were from individuals.
Okay.
So 50% of that 13% of, you know, organisations and individuals who own their own premises was actually domestic housing. So in reality, only 7% of organisations, 7% of the entire respondents were organisations who own their own buildings. So that's like this really low rate.
Oh my gosh.
So what you have is, you have like both an organisational stress, but then you have this compounding factor of what Point Chevalier Social Enterprise Trust found out, which was the incredible domestic housing stress that the arts are under, compounded by the professional housing stress. And so if you're an artist and your domestic housing is unstable and your professional housing is your domestic housing, like you're working out of your garage or your living room or that, if you're being, you know, these factors compound each other. So you might, like, have to move every 6 months because you've got a really shitty domestic landlord.
Yeah.
And you're having to professionally move every 6 months as well. Or as one person kind of reached out and told me this story where they'd basically been like, they had a studio space outside of their own home, but they were a subtenant of a subtenant of a subtenant. So every single time that kind of the top of the pyramid fell off, like moved or changed or whatever, everybody cascading underneath them had to find new accommodation. And so it was, you even didn't have this kind of autonomy to determine what your accommodation was, because you were constantly at the mercy of whatever savvy person had managed to get that really great rate in the first place.
Yeah. Far out. How did the ownership breakdown compare to, say, the early 2000s? Did you have many data sets to compare what's happening now with what's happening in the past? Or is this like the first of its kind?
Issue, well, This is pretty much the first of its kind that I am aware of in New Zealand. And it's like, if you think about it, we've been tracking data on a lot of things in the arts in the last kind of 10, 20 years. You've noticed Creative New Zealand's been putting out like loads of different reports on like artist incomes and, you know, public attitudes to the arts, but somehow how the arts are housed has sort of slipped through the cracks. You might get on an individual level like councils tracking it, but it's also this kind of great sprawling thing, like a lot of I don't know if you've ever tried to draw up a list of all the arts organizations in Dunedin, and and you know, you kind of like, you always realize you've missed some because they come, they go, they you just don't know that tiny corner of the sector.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, some are just very location oriented that you never expect, you know, other things like that. Yeah.
So if we don't have the data, we can't compare and say, you know, 20 years ago we were better housed. I mean, you know, you can say, yeah, 20 years ago we had like this great studio complex and it got redeveloped, so we know that that particular sector, that thing's never been replaced. But that's sort of very anecdotal.
Yeah, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that it is worse now, but that's interesting. There's no report about that being the case.
Yeah.
There's some interesting solutions that you propose in your report. You proposed that an independent body be created to fund and provide property development and management service to the arts and community alongside nationally consistent policy and guidance, so that artists and art orgs organizations can have some ballast and clarity about what to do and how to do it. Do you, are you very confident that the current government will, maybe implement the proposed changes that you're proposing?
So I think it's a bit of a long game that we need to be starting to have this conversation, and I think that we might, so there's a lot of different factors that play into it. And so say something like the consistent national policy, that could be driven by a ministry and or a government department, and so that's the sort of thing that often developing and investing in that kind of policy is happens despite or whatever government is in power. But it's also, you've got things like, you know, the local government New Zealand, which is actually an independent organisation, can take lead on these sorts of things. So it's not like this, the only lever to pull is national government and you're at the mercy of whatever ideology our kind of current government has. But as I think I was saying to you before we actually kicked off the interview, one of the examples I call on is the Quirk Report. And the Quirk Report was done 10, 15 years ago in the UK under a Conservative government. And the Quirk Report basically looked at it and said, you know, it is viable and feasible for us to transfer community, like local government-owned assets into community-owned hands. So long as, like, they are viable assets. We're not giving them a shitty piece of falling down tin that's they're going to spend $1 million on fixing.
Yeah.
And we manage the risks. Like, we put good process around it. And that was then kind of implemented under a Conservative government because it spoke really strongly to that kind of neoliberal divestment and subcontracting ideology. So I think it's not necessarily that we have to have a kind of liberal government to implement these kinds of changes, or that a conservative government doesn't fund the arts. I mean, sometimes, you know, we get big boosts under a conservative government. It's depending on the arts minister and how good they are around the corners. But you know, it's like, go on, Paul, you can do it. Give us more money, Paul. But I think it is also sort of one of those ones where there's a lot of different moving parts in those recommendations. So I think like the first step is actually to have that public dialogue about them, to go, what would it look like? You know, like a lot of the examples, like for example, the independent bodies, so a lot of the examples also drawn from them were from North America, where you get developers or, you know, kind of philanthropically minded developers set up arts-focused development arms, mobilizing types of tax credits and types of sort of government incentives to actually build things like work-live housing, and then have these innovative structures around how you sell them, or how so that there's not, they don't kind of immediately disappear into the private capitalist market. So these things are actually like often like, you know, property developers doing them. They're not necessarily social development things. So it's sort of kind of going, there are a whole lot of ways that we could grow ownership of buildings in the arts across the domestic and professional spheres that could be furthered by any kind of government. It's just more like actually convincing the people who have the influence that they need to be considering and thinking about this.
Yeah, well, that's refreshing to hear, because sometimes I feel like I'd do anything but fund all these good things. Thank you very much for coming.
Yeah, I mean, that being said, I mean, like, I don't think David would be in for it, but who knows? Nah. You never know.
You never know. I think that's all the time we have for this corridor. Thank you so much for coming on the program. If people want to find the report and have a read of it themselves, where can they do so?
So everything is online at stablespaces.nz.
Awesome. Stablespaces.nz. You can read the report yourself. Thank you so much for coming on the program, Melissa. It was great having you. Very good to talk to.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Of course. I'm glad you've filled the Dunedin slot in your collection of the student radio stations. It's really awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you very much. All right, that was Melissa Lang coming on to talk about the Stable Spaces survey that she ran. It was very, very fascinating stuff there. Coming up very shortly.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.